Having been raised under the big skies of Montana, I came to know the cow as the animal that converts unusable grass to usable food. And of course, I ate that food. But now I'm being told not to eat that food because the animal from which it came is destroying the climate. And so I ask, is the cow killing the climate?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1180th radio show right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Punta Arenas who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, some say the climate is changing and we have only 12 years left to stop it before it's all too late for us. And they point to the cow as being the culprit of this pending calamity. The problem is that cows pass their gas, and they pass a lot of it. According to the 2006 United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization report, cows generate more greenhouse gas emissions than cars, trucks, trains, and planes. And according to a Danish study, the average cow produces enough methane each year to do the same greenhouse damage as 4 tons of carbon dioxide. And furthermore, they tell us, to feed all those 1.5 billion cows grazing across the surface of the earth, we need to create more grasslands, and that means chopping down lots of forests, which only increases the adverse effects of all those cud-chewing critters passing their gas. What to do? Well, what those sounding the alarm want us to do, I think, is to stop eating beef. And if we don't, well, in 12 years, we will all be toast. And so before we eat one more delicious cheeseburger on Meatless Monday, we just have to ask, is the cow killing the climate? Who better to ask than Frank Mitlerner, who is a professor of animal science at the University of California, Davis. Professor Frank, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So pleased to have you aboard. Professor of Animal Science. That's a pretty big field.
Yes, it is.
And you kind of focus, though, on animals as it relates to climate or air.
Well, I'm an air quality specialist, I look at the impact that livestock has on the environment, on the atmospheric environment in particular.
Okay, good. And you are a cooperative extension professor. What exactly is cooperative extension for those who do not know?
So I have a dual appointment as a professor, a traditional professor teaching students and doing research, but then also in cooperative extension, and that means that I teach also outside the campus those people who want to know, whether that's agency personnel or whether that's farmers or whether that's NGOs. Basically I teach on and off campus.
Mm-hmm. Which do you enjoy most, the students or the people out in the field?
I think both of them are super important to me because what I learn outside the bubble informs what I teach inside the bubble.
Very good.
And so I think both is really important.
Very good. Well, you know, as a Montana boy, all of this cows is bad thing that just popped up all of a sudden in my consciousness kind of has me confused. But as a professional air quality specialist, I would assume that you saw this coming a long time ago, right?
I did see that long time ago, but nobody listened. And I think now people are more cognizant of how big this movement is, and that if they don't pay attention now, then it might be too late.
In what respect, Frank? I'm asking, do you think that we're going to lose our climate in 12 years like they're telling us?
No, I don't mean that when I say too late. Okay. What I mean by too late is that the people who are establishing this front against animal agriculture are using climate change as the main as the main point they are making. I think the same people who are now arguing that livestock is to be blamed for climate change were the earlier critics of livestock's husbandry and housing conditions. They have just identified this topic as being one that has better traction with the public. Now, do I think that animal agriculture will have a profound impact on our climate? No, I do not. And that's not to say that I'm a climate change denier. I do believe that human activities have something to do with climate change. But I also know what the contribution of livestock is. And that contribution is far from what some of those critics wanted to look like.
I think I convinced myself that humans do have something to do with climate change when I flew a little airplane over the Los Angeles basin once. I couldn't see the ground. So maybe we are doing something that's not too cool with respect to our environment. But for cows, I'm just a dumb Montana boy, and for some reason it's just not ringing the bell for me. And I suspect probably not for those who raise cattle as well. But why is it that we came to this conclusion? I mean, tell us a little bit from your perspective why humankind adopted the cow and what good we got out of adopting it.
So, in my opinion, ruminant animals are a beautiful thing, and here's why. You alluded to it earlier. They are able to take non-human edible feedstuffs, such as grass and legumes. And that's what grows on a lot of our agricultural land. About 70% of all agricultural land in the United States is marginal land, meaning cannot be used to grow crops. 70%. And the only use of that land is through ruminant animals. So cattle and sheep and goats, they can take the feedstuff that grows on that marginal land and convert it into highly bioavailable and digestible protein, namely steak and so on. So to me, it's a beautiful thing that we take something that was generated during photosynthesis, basically sun-powered product, because like it or not, what we're eating there is plant-based, and it's solar powered, and there are no additional inputs, and that's a beautiful thing. So to me, it is just far-fetched to critique that very system for environmental degradation. That's not to say that animal agriculture does not have negative environmental impacts as well. Mm-hmm. Over the last few years, we have learned to understand what those impacts are. For example, we have learned that all of beef, the entire beef supply chain in the United States, contributes to 3% of all greenhouse gases in this country. All of dairy combined contributes to 2%. Just to give you a comparison, all of those sectors of societies using fossil fuel, so that's transportation and energy production and other industries, contribute 80%, 80. So we need to get the relative importances right, and make sure that we go after the 800-pound gorillas first and foremost, and then see how we can further reduce also other sources, such as cattle.
Well, before we go to the cow itself, the animal, and the means by which it converts this useless grass to usable food, why on earth, how on earth did and the animal become a political tool?
Well, there are many people who have a stake in the ground here when it comes to an anti-animal agriculture agenda. There are some people who make a living by producing plant-based alternatives to meat and milk, and their storyline is that there's nothing worse in the world for the climate and for the environment than animal agriculture. And thus, that animal agriculture has to be replaced with either plant-based alternatives or cell-based alternatives to meat and milk. So they have their livelihood on the line.
One thinks, of course, of the Impossible hamburger, which is made out of plant-based materials.
Yeah, that's one of them. There are others.
Yes. Lots of others.
And then, so that's one group of people. Then there's another group of people that has an interest in running campaigns against animal agriculture. These are PETA and HSUS. They either have an interest in running campaigns for financial reasons. Well, most times it is financial reasons, of course, because if they can run a campaign or sue farmers, then
they get donations.
A direct financial ramification.
Okay, so we're going to have to take a quick break. Michael Olson, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Today we're talking about the cow. Is it really the enemy of the climate, like we are being told? Or is it God's gift, turning useless grass into high-density, valuable food? What do you think? This is we were with Frank Mitlerner, who is a professor, Animal Sciences, University of California. Right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
They are your enemies. They're out there telling people to stop eating beef, or it'll destroy the climate. We have 12 years left. So when you go to conferences and whatnot, I would assume that you have people speaking up against you and your notion that animals are not the enemies that they're being portrayed. Is that true?
Well, first of all, these people are not my enemies. They are people with different opinions, and I'm always open to a meaningful discussion. I think that it's pretty obvious that there are people who have an agenda that is not fact-based. For example, there are individuals who say that livestock contributes to over half of all greenhouse gases. Now, that notion is laughed out of the door by any serious climate scientist in the world. Okay, nobody who is schooled and informed about the impacts of various human activities on climate would agree with that. Yet, there are numerous people believing that livestock contributes to 51% of greenhouse gases, when indeed in the United States, the total impact is less than 5%. So
that's a significant difference. It sounds like they take a little and make it a lot, and they do it just by lying. Or they have some kind of science that they believe.
I think, well, they're at least off by an order of magnitude, you know, and that is, and that's pretty poor. Mm-hmm. Now, if they don't believe me, they can ask the Environmental Protection Agency in the United States that takes the inventory for all greenhouse gas sources, and they will tell them what the true numbers are. And the true numbers are lower by an order of magnitude compared to what the activists claim.
Well, let's turn to the cow itself. Very fascinating critter, because it's different in with respect to people, because it can actually eat grass, all that cellular matter, all that cellulosic matter in grass, and chew it up and make use of it and turn it into food that we can eat. How do they do that?
So starch and cellulose are very similar from a chemical perspective. The only difference between these two is that while both of them, glucose, are glucose molecules, they are connected to one another in different ways. We humans and all monogastric animals can cut the bond between glucose molecules in starch, but we cannot cut the bond between glucose molecules in cellulose. However, ruminant animals can do that. They have a four-chamber stomach, the largest one called the rumen, and the animals, when they graze, ingest large volumes of cellulitic material, grass, legumes, and then the microbes in the rumen can cut these bonds between the cellulitic bonds. And by doing so, they can make use of something that's non-human edible, in a way that is just a beautiful thing, in my opinion.
So there's magic there in those little bugs in the belly, right?
There is magic. It's wonderful that they can do that, but there's also an unintended consequence.
Ah.
And the unintended consequence of their ability to convert cellulose into animal protein is the fact that some of these microbes produce methane. And that methane builds up in the rumen of these animals, and then it's belched out. It's coming out the front end. And that is the unintended consequence.
So it's the front end and not the rear end. So all of the jokes we hear about animal farts causing the global warming are not true.
Yeah, they're not true. That's correct. And I have told many people that, including the Congresswoman AOC, that in my opinion, this whole notion of farting cows might be amusing to some, but it belittles a topic that is too important to make fun of. We should take this whole issue of climate impacts of human activity serious, and by referring to it, by mentioning farting animals, is just not getting us there.
Now, did the congressperson come to you, or did you go to her?
I saw a tweet that she put out that I disagreed with, and so I tweeted back.
Good.
And a couple hours later, her initial tweet was gone, and a week later, we had conversations with her office that were very fruitful.
Well, great. And that's good to hear. So it does help to speak up when you hear something that just doesn't make any sense to you. And, of course, the gas that the cows pass is methane, correct?
Yes.
And methane is a global warming gas.
So
climate change gas or whatever they call it these days.
Yeah, they call it greenhouse gas.
There
are three of those. Well, there are numerous, but three main ones. One is CO2, carbon dioxide. That's what you and I exhale right now. CO2, and that also stems from burning fossil fuels. Then the second one is methane, and methane is about 28 times more potent than CO2. And the third time is nitrous oxide. And nitrous oxide is almost 300 times more heat-trapping than CO2. Now, there are other differences between these gases that are very important, namely that they have a different lifespan. Meaning once these gas molecules are in the air, they have a lifespan that's greatly different, with CO2, carbon dioxide, having a lifespan of 1,000 years, and methane having a lifespan of 10 years. And that has a profound impact on its biogeochemical importance.
So it dissipates much more rapidly than CO2.
The beautiful thing about methane is that in contrast to CO2 and nitrous oxide, there is actually a process in the atmosphere that destroys methane, and that's called hydroxyoxidation. And that is, I don't want to drift into chemistry now, but it is a process by which methane is destroyed, and that takes about 10 years.
So there it is. And yet we keep adding to it, and that's why I'm sure that they point to this as being a significant problem. Now, a lot of advocates of not eating meat suggests the big problem is in that in the way we raise them, we instead of having them out grazing on the grass of Montana prairies, we have them in confined animal feeding operations and feeding them grain on top of that. Does that make a big difference?
So this also is a misconception. Now, I'm among those who love the scenic view of cattle on pasture, so don't get me wrong. When I'm saying what I'm about to say, when you just look at the facts of, let's say, the carbon footprint of a grass-finished versus a corn-finished steer, then the following considerations must be considered. A corn-finished animal that stays on pasture first with its mom and then by itself for about 10 or so months will be in the feedlot for another 4 months. So 14, 15, 16 months of age, that corn-finished animal will go to the packing plant. Its grass-finished peer will stay on grass its entire life, and it will stay alive and go to the packing plant at around 26 to 30 months of age. So the grass-finished animal does not live 14 or 15 months, but it lives almost twice as long. And secondly, it eats a diet, the grass-finished animal eats a diet that's very high in roughage.
Cellulose, right.
And that roughage or fiber, that material is the substrate for methane production. Because those microbes in the rumen, they cannot deal with corn. They do not produce methane from corn-based diets. They need roughage, and that roughage is contained on pasture.
Oh.
And therefore, grass-finished animals don't have a lower, but they actually have a higher carbon footprint, even if you consider all externalities of corn production and so on.
So when it comes to the fact that we use these CAFOs, these confined animal feeding operations, to raise cattle, is not a significant consideration with respect to greenhouse gases. As a matter of fact, we're saving there.
Well, you might not like CAFOs for many reasons, but the reason of
the
greenhouse
one.
Gases should not be the one.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, I, for one, am still eating meat on Meatless Mondays. I'm sure that I guess it's probably because I was raised in Montana and ate a lot of meat when I was growing up, and I'm stubborn now and I'm not about to change. But there seems to be a lot of people out there who are eating, going meatless on Mondays. And so today we're trying to figure out if this really is a solution to the problem of global warming. They say, you know, the climate's changing. We got to do something. In 12 years, we're all toast. Do something quick. Quit eating beef. Well, should we? And that gets us to the fact that, you know, when we really take a look at all of this hyperbole that we hear, it seems like there's a lot of politics mixed with a very little bit of science. Is that what you see, Professor?
Absolutely. Now, before I move on, you mentioned Meatless Monday several times. I just want to give you a number so that you know whether or not you should go Meatless Monday. So if we as a nation with 320 million people were to forego the eating of beef on one day a week, on Monday or whatever day of the week, then that would reduce the nation's carbon footprint by 0.3%. If we as a nation were to go vegan, so no animal-based products whatsoever, we would reduce the carbon footprint of the United States by 2.6%. So before you make dietary changes to protect the climate, just know how much or how little that would do.
And evidently not very much at all with respect to the climate. Well, you know, let's do get into these numbers. And in considering what you have had to say in some of your writings, I'm brought back to Mark Twain and what he said about numbers and these lies, damn lies, and statistics. And that seems to be a lot of the case here. Whereas the World Health Organization says the numbers, 51% of the greenhouse gases are from cows, you're saying that's not close at all.
No, that's not the World Health Organization. That's the
World Watch Institute.
World Watch Institute, which is a grandiose name, but it's actually a group of three people who gave themselves a grandiose name, and they don't have any scientific credibility, in my opinion, at all. So, but once you give yourself a name like that, you sound like something big.
Well, 51% is certainly a big number. So if you're going to give yourself a grandiose name, you should give yourself a big number to go along with it. And 51% is a big one.
Yeah, that is a very big one.
But
I don't know if you heard about it, but the so-called Cowspiracy, another little propaganda piece that came out a couple of years ago that was watched millions of times, picked up that number. And I have to say, they couldn't be further from the truth. And since then, Cowspiracy has changed their number. But it seems some other people, like Beyond Meat, have not changed it. They use that 51% number.
Well, and then it's pretty easy to use that number, too. If you're an advocate for one side or the other, you pick up the numbers that you want to use, and then you use them and you pound them into the ground until people think, wow, cows are really bad. But if we pick up the numbers that are put up by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, they look a lot different than the 51%, do they not?
Well, the EPA compares all sectors of society and its greenhouse gases and other environmental pollutants. According to the EPA, all of livestock combined emits a total of approximately 4% direct emissions for greenhouse gases. Now, the reason why that number is slightly lower than the 3% for beef and the 2% for dairy I cited earlier is that they only look at what's called direct emissions. But the general number of, you know, around 4-5% holds true no matter what assessment method you use.
So, and then you quote some numbers from the EPA relating to other things. For example, electricity contributes 28% of our greenhouse gases. So is that from, surely it's not from wind farms, right? It's from coal burning power plants and natural gas, right?
So there are three sources that almost emit the same, and that is 1, power production and use, 2, transportation, and 3, industry, so cement industry and so on. Each one of these three sectors produces about 28-30% of the total. So, and what they all have in common is that they are significant users of fossil fuels. And let me explain really quickly what that means. Fossil fuels are oil, coal, and gas. And they have been stored in the ground for a very long time, formerly decayed plant material. And within a very short period of time, 50, 60 years or so, we have extracted about half of that fossil fuel from the ground, and we have burned it. And by burning it, we have put that fossil fuel, that pure carbon, from the ground where it was before into the atmosphere where it is now. And every time the sun hits those molecules, these molecules trap the heat from the sun. And that's why most climate scientists will tell you that it's the use of fossil fuel that's the main anthropogenic, meaning human-caused, contribution to climate change.
So what I see when I fly a little airplane over Los Angeles Basin are those hydrocarbons that we pulled out of the ground and burned them up, and there they are sitting in the atmosphere. And that's just part of it, though, right? Because a lot of it we can't see. It's way up high.
It is a big part of it. So the greatest contributions, human contributions to climate change are by means of CO2 emissions. And then methane, of course, also matters. Methane is not just emitted from ruminant animals. It is emitted when you extract fossil fuels. It is also emitted from other biological processes, let's say rice growing, biofuel burn, biomass burning, wetlands, and so on. So there are almost weekly reports coming out that show us additional sources of methane that are really new. Like today, I tweeted a report about methane from trees. I mean,
methane from trees?
Yeah, methane from trees. A significant source of methane that has not been reported so far. Today it was reported in the National Geographic. Very unusual.
How do trees emit methane? Are they making seeds or oils or something?
It's a good question. You know, I have enough to do with my cows. I don't know anything about trees.
Well, let me get to the real question that has me stumped, and probably just about everybody else who considers all of this, Frank, is how are we to figure out what is real and what is not with respect to these numbers?
Well, I think we have many credible sources in this country. There are many credible scientists, and there are also agencies that I have a great deal of trust in. And I think that these are the ones we should pay attention to, and not those who obviously have a conflict of interest and big dollars to be made.
Well, that's a frustration too, because you just really don't know which ones are which. And you see something like World Watch, and you think, my goodness, that must be a very big organization because it's a World Watch. But yet there's three people, you say, in an office, and so there you go. But we've got to take a quick break, but I'd like to pursue this, and I'd like to ask you about science itself, because you are a scientist, and the influences that act upon science that sometimes lead us astray as well. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Professor Frank Mitlerner, University of California, Davis. Is the cow killing our climate? Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, that's the question in my mind always is, who do I believe in? How much credence do I give them? When I was told that I should no longer eat beef, I just thought, well, wait a minute. Something just isn't ringing true here to me. How do I find out the other side of the story? And you said something very interesting, Frank, a while ago, is that you don't have any enemies with respect to contending for the public's perception here. But in a sense, you do, because, you know, you both have two different sides of the story, and you're trying to get your side across. And those of us out here in the world, we're looking at both sides, we see that you work with agriculture, so we kind of think, well, you're on one side of it, and then we see these other people over here, and maybe they're working for the Impossible Burger Company or something like that, and they have the other side. So how on earth are we supposed to just get a grip on what's what? Eating what?
So I work for the University of California, the world's foremost public institution in this field, and also the world's leading institution on agriculture and environmental issues. And I'm an advocate for science. That's really what I am.
You are a scientist.
I'm not on the one side or the other. In fact, sometimes I have research findings that people in agriculture don't like, and sometimes they do like it. And that's just the way it turns out. But at the end of the day, fact-based information will always make us as society win, okay? Mm-hmm. I do not view these other people as my enemies. They sometimes do view me as theirs, but there's an old Chinese saying, never wrestle with a pig. You both get dirty and the pig will like it. So I'm not going down there, okay? I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that on Twitter or anywhere else, mm-hmm. but... You asked earlier.
But you do contend, as you mentioned about the congresswoman, you know, who brought up the fact that, you know, we're all going to die in 12 years unless we stop eating meat. You stood up to her. You said, well, it's not true. And you were somehow able through that to develop a dialogue. So you do have to contend.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I like to convey fact-based information. I think that's my job as the person I am. Yeah. But that doesn't make me hate them or dislike them or so. But that just means that I'm trying to advance the discussion to get us someplace. You know, it is really ridiculous that we have food fights of the type that we do have. And this is more than just, hey, I like to eat this and you like to eat that. This is people who feel that it's almost their religious calling to be a missionary about their own food choice, and up until the point where they have convinced everybody else, they will not rest. And that's not acceptable. I eat what I want to eat, and you will not tell me what I will eat. You will not tell me who I will pray for or who I will vote for or what I will eat. This is a very personal decision that I can make and that I think is very important for us from a cultural perspective, from a personal perspective. And nobody has the right to tell me what to eat. And I have to tell you, I get allergic when people try that. And people do try that. For example, the recent E-Lancet report, a major report that wants to take your choice of what you eat away from you by either making certain food choices so expensive that you can't afford them, or by changing subsidies and educational system and so on, so that that those choices are taken away from you. I think that is deeply discerning to me.
Well, yeah. I was, as you were talking, I was thinking of the children in school. You know, you have people like you who are willing to stand up and say, well, wait a minute, this isn't really correct. What about this? And you do it to Congress people, but you know, you get children in the classroom and they get one side of the story only.
Yes, and that's a big problem. You know, agriculture has a large share in this, because for the longest time, people in agriculture, when hearing these outrageous claims, just leaned back and said, you know, we know that's not true, and we don't believe in any of that anyhow. You know, leave us alone with these topics and so on. These times, I have to tell you, these times are over. And people have to understand that there are certain topics that are of high societal significance. And society is who buys your products. And if you say, well, society wants X, but I don't care about X, then you effectively don't care about the people buying your products. And that makes no sense. I think agriculture needs to lead the discussion about sustainability. Agriculture needs to own that. Agriculture needs to say, we know what our impacts are because they have been studied, they have been published. We know what they are, and we have made commitment to further reduce our impacts. Mm-hmm. That's more than anybody else in society can say.
Do you think the big problem is that most of us are no longer farmers, and we don't live on the land, and we have no connection with our food chain? And so we're living in these big concrete cities, and we're vulnerable to people telling us things that we have no knowledge of. Folks, there you go. Folks, this is the Food Chain. We're going to have one more break, and when we come back, we're going to ask Professor Frank Mitlerner the real big question, which is on the table. It's there. It's real. People are telling us if we don't quit eating beef, we're going to die in 12 years. And they're very important people telling us this. So we're going to ask the professor what he thinks. Is it true? Is the cow going to kill our climate? This is the Food Chain, right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
There is so little time. They say 12 years, that's not much time, given how long, you know, we've been on the surface of the earth. 12 years, you got to quit eating hamburger or it's over. And you listen to it, and you listen to it, and you listen to it, and people running for the presidency of the United States are saying it. Congress people are saying it. School teachers are saying it. And they're really serious about it. If we don't quit eating beef, it's all going to come to an end. But is that true? As a Montana boy, it just doesn't ring true to me. Professor, how about you?
Well, I think what most people say is that within the foreseeable future, we need to make a real difference with respect to our use of fossil fuels. So the way we drive, the way we cool or heat our homes, the way we insulate our homes, the way and frequency with which we fly, those things have a major impact. What we eat has a minor impact. The problem is, and here's what you hear, those people who don't like animal agriculture, they use global numbers for the impact livestock has on the environment.
Now, what does that mean?
And the reason why they do that is because the rest of the world has livestock that's much less efficient than we do here. For example, you need about 20 times the number of cows in India to produce the same amount of milk as one cow here in the United States. 5 times more in Mexico than one cow here. So that comes with very high environmental footprints in these countries. And so those people critiquing animal agriculture like to use global averages and then apply those global averages to the United States, well knowing that they should not be applied here because that's erroneous. But they are doing it. And this is the oldest trick on the books. I've been saying this forever. Now, if you want to follow these discussions, you can. I have a Twitter account, and you will see this being very active and highly frequented.
So, well, what is that Twitter account?
It is GHG Guru, GHGGURU. And there are about 2.5 million people checking in every month, so it must be a topic of high relevance.
GHU Guru.
No, GHG for greenhouse gas.
Ah.
GHG Guru.
Got it. GHG Guru. Okay, so that's the way to do it. Now, but what do you think? Are they telling us the truth?
I think the truth is that we must reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. That's the truth. I don't think that what we eat will have a significant impact. It does have some impact, but the impact is very minor. I think that what's also very important to mention is that livestock is not only about greenhouse gases, okay? Environmental effects around livestock are many, many, and so many impacts of livestock are positive. Biosystem services of animals include weed control, fuel control. Think of the wildfires in California.
Oh, man.
And how much of that could be reduced by reducing fuel load.
And one way of reducing fuel loads is to get cattle to eat all of that stuff that we won't eat. And there you
exactly.
are.
Exactly.
Folks, Professor Frank Mitlerner, Professor of Animal Sciences, University of California, GHG guru. Look him up. Thank you very much, Frank, for joining me, and thank you all for tuning in The Food Chain. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain? Cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.